All right, why don't we get started? Whoa, that's loud. Sorry about that. I'm Deborah Starr. I'm the chair of the Near Eastern Studies Department. And thank you, those of you in person, those of you on Zoom, for joining us. I'm really, really excited about today's event. This event is sponsored by the Near Eastern Studies Department with the support of the Department of Literatures and English, Department of History of Art and Visual Studies at Cornell, the Society for the Humanities, and the American Studies Program. So thank you to all of our sponsors. I wanted to actually start off with an introduction for one of our current students before I introduce our speaker today. But the way we've set things up is I am going to hand over the mic, and when we get to Q&A, we have one of our current Near Eastern Studies majors who will be handling the questions. So this is, I'd like to introduce Danielle Greco, who is a concurrent degree student earning a BA in Near Eastern Studies and a BFA in Fine Arts here at Cornell, and is particularly interested in how art pertains to Near Eastern societies and gender. With these skills, she has held several unique internships with the United States government. After she graduates in May, she plans to attend Harvard University to obtain an MA in Middle Eastern Studies. And we're really delighted to have Danielle's participation tonight. So she'll get us started with some questions for Andy, and then she'll be the one to help field questions from the audience, both in person and online. I am absolutely thrilled to have Andy Warner back at Cornell. Andy is a Boards Cornell class of 2006 and is the author of some of his books, Pests and Pets, Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, which I don't have a copy of at the moment, and Spring Rain. And I wanted to tell a little bit about both this book and my work with Andy. Andy wrote a senior thesis under my direction on the Lebanese writer Hoda Barakat, on her novel The Stone of Laughter. Fast forward to 2019 when Hoda visited campus, and I hadn't thought about Andy for a long time, but like it came back to me, and I felt, isn't it a shame that Andy wasn't here when Hoda visited? And lo and behold, just a few months later, I get an email that Andy's book, Spring Rain, had just come out, in which he talks about his experiences, somewhat as a Cornell student, but mostly as a study abroad student in Lebanon in 2005. So it was really the sort of fortuitous confluence. And that came out in 2020. A lot of people had time to read books, right? So Andy's books have been translated into Russian, Chinese, Korean, French, and Spanish. He's a contributing editor at the NIB, and he teaches cartooning at Stanford and at the Animation Workshop in Denmark. Please join me in welcoming Andy for our lecture today, Power Platforms and Pipelines, Transnational Nonfiction Comics, and the 21st Century. Welcome back for now.
Thank you, Deborah, for having me. It is such a pleasure and honor to be here, sincerely. And it's very special to be back. I spent all of the day walking around, breathing in the air, and feeling very Proustian. So I'll get off to a start with this. My name is Andy Warner, as you were all just made aware of. I specialize in nonfiction comics. So I'm a cartoonist, I draw comics, but I pretty much only draw nonfiction comics. I work in nonfiction comics in a lot of ways. I'm a writer artist, so that means I write my books and also draw them. I'm a writer for other people's books that they draw. So one of my books, This Land is My Land, is about utopias. I wrote that one and somebody else drew that. I'm an illustrator, so that means somebody else writes and then I illustrate their book. I'm working on a book right now that's coming out next year in that capacity. I'm also an editor, that means I work with other people's nonfiction comics. I'm a publisher, I have published other people's nonfiction comics. And as a teacher, I pretty much only teach nonfiction comics. Nonfiction comics, nonfiction comics, nonfiction comics. So what does that actually mean? I use the medium of comics to work with nonfiction. This includes creating journalism, popular histories, memoirs, explainers, and occasionally advocacy. I use the skills, sorry for the people there, working in nonfiction comics, to teach nonfiction comics at Stanford, the California College of the Arts, the Animation Workshop in Denmark. I work with both enormous faceless corporate publishers and small presses. I've run my own periodical and helped others run theirs. The most visible part of my career is in publishing. I'm the author of 4 books. One of them is a memoir and 3 are histories. Spring Rain came out from St. Martin's in 2020. It was a memoir of political violence and uprisings in Lebanon between 2005 and 2011. Pests and Pets came out from Little Brown in 2021. That's my most recent book. It's YA audience. It's how the animals that we love or who love us change the world. It's basically about the Anthropocene and domestication. This Land Is My Land came out from Chronicle in 2019. That was a collaboration where I wrote the text and a friend and former student drew the art. And it was a survey of utopian projects and all consuming artistic visions. And then my first book was Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, which came out from Picador in 2017. And it was funny, 4 pageable histories with length and mundanity as an ironclad constraint. So I'm going to tell you about my own background because I'm going to spend a lot of this talking about the background of others, and I think it's important to talk about my own. I'm American. I was born in California. I also spent a significant portion of my childhood outside the continental United States. My dad is a marine biologist, and our family would often live at his field research stations, especially in Panama, St. Croix, and Corsica. The pictures of me as a child, we lived with an indigenous community called the Guna in Panama. On a series of small islands called the San Blas Archipelago. From 2002 to 2006, I did my undergrad here at Cornell, double majoring in Near Eastern Studies and Comparative Literature. Here's a little drawing. In 2005, I studied abroad at the American University of Beirut, AUB, as I will hereafter refer to it. I lived in the Hamra neighborhood. AUB is very lovely. So most of the art in here is going to be my own art. Some of it drawn from my books, some from other projects. If I'm showing other people's art, I'll let you know. I'm also going to be reading other comics at a certain point during the talk. Being an American in the Middle East in 2005 meant living in the shadow of America's war in Iraq. Conversations in Beirut would inevitably circle back to Baghdad. But Beirut in 2005 was also on the rise. A generation had grown up without civil war. The Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon had ended 5 years previously, Syria's occupation was ongoing, and the city was in a building boom. This abruptly ended with the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Hariri had been one of the richest politicians in the world in the face of Beirut's post-civil war reconstruction. I think at his height, he was the 4th richest politician in the world. That small. The shocking killing was blamed on the Syrian occupying army and their ally in Lebanon, Hezbollah. Syria had largely controlled the country's politics since the end of the civil war. After being initially pro-Syrian, Hariri was positioning himself in opposition, a threat to eliminate. Protests erupted immediately, demanding the withdrawal of Syrian troops and the dissolution of the Lebanese government. 5 years before the quote-unquote Arab Spring swept through the region, the frustrated people of Lebanon took to the streets to demand the end of their own government. At one point, a quarter of the country was in the streets of the capital calling for the fall of the regime. I was there too, of course, because I was 21 and was incredibly excited. Within days, if not hours, politics in the country had split along familiar sectarian lines. There were counter-protests, there were occupations, there was a lot of honking and flags. So Lebanon is set up as a sectarian democracy by its constitution. There's a power-sharing agreement that basically ended the civil war, and it enshrines sectarianism into law that makes the state sort of captured by these interests that in a period of strife reassert themselves. These interests are also often armed. A wave of political violence followed, both assassinations and targeted bombings. It seems like it was meant to inflame divisions. To this day, the perpetrators of these attacks remain unknown as to their true motivation, which is a pretty chilling thing. The killers of Hariri have actually been indicted by a court that was set up by the UN. It's the only time that's ever happened. Because the country decided it couldn't prosecute itself, but the 4 people all members of vanished immediately, and nothing was ever said of it again. Justice for political violence in Lebanon is sort of often not brought to a satisfying conclusion in judiciary. I'll put it that way. But the uprising worked, kind of. The Syrian army left and the government fell, but nothing really changed. The same political parties shuffled the deck, and most people ended up worse off. That's how things go. I started drawing a lot of comics during this time. I was living alone in an apartment, and I'd go for walks or to the protests, then come home and draw. I returned to the US in Cornell that summer. After graduating in 2006, I moved to San Francisco. I was still drawing comics, and in 2007, through friends of friends, I was introduced through email to a Beirut-based comic collective called Samanda. The first comic I ever had published appeared in their first issue, which is there, and I've actually brought it today. It's up there on that table. And then I did the cover art for their second issue ever, which I also brought. I drew a little scary dude making an evil potion. Samanda, Arabic for salamander, was started by a group of four friends. Omar Khoury, who was Lebanese, grew up in the UK and Lebanon, went to university in the US. Hatem Inam, who's Lebanese, grew up in Beirut. Lena Merej, German-Lebanese, grew up in Lebanon, went to university in Germany. And the Fitz, who's Syrian-Lebanese, grew up in Lebanon and Syria. It had comics in Arabic, French, and English, the languages commonly spoken in Lebanon. Recruiting foreign cartoonists for their magazine was not unusual. Lebanese youth culture is very tied to the diaspora, which was swollen by the Lebanese Civil War, but predates it by 50 years, if not a century. At this time, I kept making comics for Samanda. I appeared in the first 11 issues, while also working as a graphic designer in San Francisco and trying unsuccessfully to get a puppet. Then the economy crashed. I lost all my freelance clients and decided to go to grad school for comics because everything else was a dumpster fire. Anyway, this was 2008, 2009. So I got my MFA from the Center for Cartoon Studies between 2010 and 2012 in Vermont. Lovely school, great place to study comics if anybody is interested in that. In the middle of my time there, my partner's work took her from Dakar to Beirut in the spring and summer of 2011. After my semester ended, I joined her there, finally meeting the Samanda crew in person and guest editing an issue of the magazine with them. This is me and Lena Merej working the merch table at a 2011 Samanda rooftop release party. Cool screen prints. It probably still happens in the closet somewhere. Samanda's editorship has changed over the years as the collective's membership shifts. In spring of 2011, I worked closely with Omar Khoury to put together issue 11. So these are a bunch of different Samanda issues that have appeared over the years. Samanda had been founded as an explicitly transnational publication. It solicited pitches worldwide from the first issue. Contributors were from Europe, the Arab world, North America, etc. Published in three languages, English, French, Arabic, and it fostered networks of copyright-free international distribution. On every page, copyright page of a Samanda, it says you can copy this, you can distribute it, get it out there, et cetera. That was their ethos from the beginning, sort of a 90s zine culture ethos. Working with Omar for about 3 months on issue 11, I saw how they put together the magazine, from coordinating with contributors to arranging the stories to wrangling the printers. So this is me doing screen printing with Omar and Hatem for little zines that we were making as the companion for issue 11, which was the issue that I worked on. And it has a really elaborate die cut cover. So if you come and look at it, please be careful because Omar did not put a lot of thought into how the die cut cover would hold up like 6 years later. But it's very pretty. So after returning to Vermont that fall to finish my degree, I wrote a 16-page mini comic about Rafik Hariri's assassination in 2005 and Beirut in 2011 for a class assignment. I had made a few short nonfiction comics before, but mostly worked in fiction. The Man Who Built Beirut was my first longer experiment. I found that I was good at making nonfiction, and I also liked it. So it's an important thing if you're going to make it your job. I graduated with an MFA in comics in 2012 from the Center for Cartoon Studies. And my first book was published in 2017. So there's a 5-year gap between that. In those 5 years, I made a living doing freelance comics and illustration work. I graduated with an MFA, and I've basically been a full-time merchant ever since then. Mostly, I've worked in the field of comics journalism. That means using the medium of comics to produce work as a journalist for media outlets. My knowledge of Middle Eastern politics got me work. Not only did I have a network of friends amongst cartoonists in the region, but I had kept up with the news and analysis since my undergraduate years. I lived twice in Beirut and traveled all throughout the region. This was also in 2012, unfortunately, as the Syrian uprising became the Syrian civil war. Intense violence between several different state and non-state actors causing a huge amount of people to flee the deadly conflict. As an American with an understanding of the region, I was paid to interpret what was unfolding in Syria and Iraq for an American audience. So I was acting as a journalist, being paid, writing about the region for a primarily American audience in American publications. I was not the only cartoonist from outside the region to get swept up in this. Disaster and crisis provoke fascination. And fascination will at last create interpretive industries. These are some of the other examples of different books. This is like just a fraction of all. It became a whole cottage industry. But I didn't only work about creating work about the sort of Arab winter and refugee crisis. I soon broadened what I was reporting on off into other subjects, often working in science reporting. Comics are a really great medium for that. This visual interpretation really sticks around. I also sold lots of nonfiction on wide-ranging bizarre topics that just interested me. So I wrote about when Google went on a spree buying robots. I got to write an article about Google's robots. I got to write an article about the python hunters in Florida who have to catch the 17-foot-long pythons and grab them by their tail and yank them. And that's how they tear them out. It whips around you and then you run away. And then it runs away, and then you run after it, and you grab it by the tail. You do it again. You do that until it gets tired, and then you put a tracking device on it, and then you track it back to its friend and kill all of them. And so I got to write about these people. It's fun. Journalism is great. You meet so many bizarre, interesting people. One of them was this Colombian-Australian woman named Maria Fernanda Cardoso, who is a artist, a sculptor, and she had created these flea circuses and also these big sculptures of three-dimensional insect genitalia, which sounds like a weird aside, but I'll get back to it in a minute and you'll see. So now we're gonna go. So in 2014, I was invited by a program with the US State Department to do comic workshops in Bahrain. It was pretty weird, I'm not gonna lie. Bahrain is home to the US Navy base that basically allows America to project power in the Gulf. I met with Bahraini cartoonists, shared a room with a cardboard cutout of Barack Obama, and was introduced to a US Marine cosplaying as a stormtrooper, which frankly is a little on the nose. It wasn't my only or most consequential brush with the State Department. In 2016, as part of cultural programming by the US Embassy in Egypt, I attended the Cairo Comics Festival. The festival was funded in part by the US and French embassies in Egypt. Cairo Comics was headlined by the Tok Tok Collective, a Cairo-based group of cartoonists publishing an anthology. Some of their founders have been in earlier Simandl issues. While there, I got to give a talk at the American University of Cairo Nonfiction Comics. Starting back from the city, my State Department minder pointed at a rusted construction site and said something that has always stuck with me ever since then. The cuts in the land just don't go away here. It never rains. Simandl's influence on comics, collective, publishing a periodical anthology was evident on Tok Tok and throughout the region. Collectives from Lebanon, Egypt, Iraq, and Morocco and the Gulf had either come to Cairo Comics or sent their books there to be sold by friends. It was an amazing networking event. But anytime people start flying you places or giving you money, it's never a bad idea to pause and ask what's going on. So why is the State Department interested in comics? Comics are a part of American soft power. Familiarity breeds affection. And it's not an accident that these programs are happening in countries like, sorry for the misspelling, Egypt, Bahrain, with vested American interests in a population that might not be too keen on the local expression of US power. It's not great, but the CIA also funded literary journals and abstract expressionism, and at least state does it out in the open. At the end of the day, we're all working on the Death Star. Trump was elected that fall, which put an end to the Department of State currying goodwill abroad for a few years. I got to meet a bunch of people and talk to them about comics, and that was pretty much the end of that adventure. It was also in 2016 that I began to work as a contributing editor at a nonfiction political comics publisher and website called The Noob. I mostly work in the print magazine, with commissions short and long nonfiction around a single theme like death or power. We've published 13 issues since 2018, won several awards, and had book projects optioned from the contributor-owned work we've published. When I work as an editor at The Nib, I mainly am working editing other people's nonfiction stories. So I do produce my own work for them, but I commission, I solicit pitches, I am pitched to, and I work closely with the people on both their scripts and all the visuals of their stories as they come out. So I'm just going to explain what The Nib is for a second, because it's going to form a big arc of the next part of this story. The Nib was founded in 2013 by Matt Boers. Matt Boers is a political cartoonist. He's been a political cartoonist since he was in college. He was actually one of the youngest, last young political cartoonists that existed, because he came up in the world of free alt weeklies. Who here remembers free alt weeklies? It was an ecosystem that was once enormous, but pretty much no longer exists because they were entirely dependent on paid classified advertising, which Craigslist began to develop in the mid-2000s. It is crazy, though, the way that the alt weeklies were both a cradle of cartoonists, critics, and writers, and they once existed and now they are gone. And it's because of an advertising model shift. At the same time as the alt weeklies began to die off, the ecosystem of cartoonists that it supported began to migrate online. Tech took notice and tech money began to flow into comics. The first stop was a place called Medium. Medium was founded by Twitter co-founder Ev Williams, the little blue bird. So Matt Boers had been introduced to comics journalism by Joe Sacco, whose books Palestine and Safe Area Garage Day had created a newly prestigious space for the medium. In 2010, Boers raised money and funded a trip to Afghanistan with fellow cartoonist Ted Raw. From the beginning, he wanted to cross that tradition of comics journalism with the political cartooning that he had come up in the world of alt weeklies that actually brings in the outraged eyeballs. This is a pretty classic model of journalism, actually, where you have sort of like clickbaity outrage stuff that supports the longer prestige piece. Anyway, this is Joe Sacco. This is Matt Boers. You can kind of see the stylistic inspiration between the two of them. Boers, again, kind of fast, is the guy who founded The Nib. But before we get back to him, I want to give you guys a quick aside here about Joe Sacco, because he is very important to my industry. Joe Sacco was born in Malta. His childhood was in Australia, and he moved to America at age 12 and has lived mostly in Oregon since then. He took out credit card debt to go to the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem in the 1990s, serializing his reporting from there through Fantagraphics for an American audience. This is really interesting. So he self-funded his own grip on credit cards and then basically established my industry that exists like 40 years later. Not telling you guys to get into debt, but his two landmark books in the 1990s, Palestine and Safe Area Garage, they established comics journalism as a viable practice for cartoonists in America. Here are some of the original Fantagraphics covers from the series Palestine. It's a great collection. All his books are really good. It's a lot sort of rougher and more cartoony than a lot of his later work. The 2000s opened with 9/11 and were defined by the American wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Throughout this time, Sacco not only published new books, but also produced comics journalism for prominent American and British publications, including the Boston Globe, Harper's, The Guardian, and The New York Times. He actually embedded with US soldiers for the invasion and then wrote a piece explaining why he did that. The 2000s were also the college years of the enormous US millennial generation that I belonged to. Many editors who went on to found and run the new media publishing websites of the 2010s and today grew up reading Sacco's work. Some, myself included, were assigned to books in college courses here. So he's entering into the academy. Symbolia, the 2000s ended. Comics journalism had come into its own. You no longer had to make a case to editors that it was a serious use of the medium. In fact, for the first time, there were entire publications devoted to it. One was an iPad magazine called Symbolia. For a minute around 2012, a bunch of people thought that iPad-only magazines would be a big thing. They were totally not a big thing. Anyway, because I was drawing lots of comic journals, and for everyone else, I also started to draw some for Symbolia. A bunch of 20 and 30-year-olds were also making comic journalism around this time, too, not just me. All of us were influenced by Joe Sacco. This work was getting published in places like Symbolia, as well as getting distributed through zine distribution networks and indie comics conventions. A couple examples of my favorite friends from that era were the Illustrated Press in Chicago, which was a group of three artists that functioned as a collective, and Susie Cagle out of Oakland, who did amazing work covering the Occupy protest. So Matt Bors of the Nib is impressed by my drawings of insect genitalia for a Symbolia story. There it is again, and tweets a joke at me about them. We started talking, and soon he asked me to do nonfiction comics for the Nib. The Nib, unlike any of the earlier publications like Symbolia or the Cartoon Picayune, has a ton of money to play with because of their tech funding. There's Ev Williams, Twitter money. I get hired to do weird nonfiction comics for them on a monthly basis. I'm basically a columnist for them. For a little while, I get to create comics journalism about everything from Boko Haram to the Hog Island Oyster Company. I pitch them three stories a month. They would pick one, we would develop it together, and it would get published. So again, a moment of great exuberance. People are giving you things. It's often good to pause and think about what's going on here. Medium is trying to build an audience. It has hired a bunch of different kinds of people to bring eyeballs to their network with free content that is designed to be shareable. And other existing social networks then keep people inside the Medium ecosystem. They hope to eventually monetize this network in some way, either by selling ads, licensing IP, gatekeeping, or selling the company and any IP generated by it. At this point, Medium is designed as a network of publications, most of which are structured like blogs or magazines. Medium hires prominent writers and editors from sites around the internet and has negotiated contracts where they own the publication and IP generated for it. The Nib alone is different. Matt Bors has negotiated creator contracts with Medium in which creators own the intellectual property they generate for the site. This is a constant throughout the existence of the Nib. Creators have always owned everything that is generated for the Nib. They only license things on a three-month period of exclusivity. I believe, especially in the publish industry, rent seeking should be stamped out as much as possible. If a cartoonist creates something, they should have the rights to sell it as their own book. Anyway, so he licenses the comics he commissioned for a short period of exclusivity. Cartoonists are notoriously shifty. We've been screwed over as an industry a bunch of times. There's always these horror stories. And also Matt Bors has just been watching the implosion of the alt-weekly ecosystem for the past decades. So he's a little trigger shy. Good thing, because with no warning, Medium pivots from being a publishing network up to a social network. Employees hired over the previous 2 years to staff publications at the center of the previous company vision are hired en masse, including Nib staffers, Matt Bors, Larry Harris, and Maddie Lipchansky. Matt Bors retains the Nib name, artists retain their rights to their comics. This is the first time that the name might have died. Instead, it rose like a zombie and went into a Kickstarter. Bors used the Kickstarter funds to pay for the licensing of existing comics in the first 2 years and print the book. The small money flowing into the scene, as well as the promotion from the Kickstarter campaign, keeps the network of nonfiction comics and journalism connected. Then tech money flows back into comics. First Look Media buys the Nib and adds it to their expanding media empire, which also included The Intercept, Field of Vision, and Comic. First Look Media was founded by eBay founder Pierre Omidyar, another friendly oligarch. It was at this point that I got hired on as a contributing editor at the Nib. That meant that I was creating weekly and monthly comics for the Nib as a contractor, not an employee. While at the same time, I was soliciting pitches from and editing comics by other contributors. The Nib was relaunched at the Democratic National Convention to gain attention as it covered the Trump versus Clinton election. From the beginning, it was more often explicitly political than its first iteration. The DNC launch was very, very weird. W. Kamau Bell was there. By weird, I mean really, really weird. They made these giant posters. So aside from making enormous posters of the Clintons, what is the Nib doing at this point? It's setting up a pipeline. The Nib has a big funding. It has a vague mission, more on that later. Social media accounts and an email list would reach. This means that it has a platform. How others are brought to that platform is the pipeline. During the First Look Media era, the Nib was edited by Matt Bors, Maddie Lipchansky, Shea Burke, Larry Harris, and me. We each lived in different places, had different focuses, and personal histories that shaped our network. Mine were shaped in two major ways, working on an indie comics anthology called Irene, I'll talk about it a little bit later, and my association with the Lebanese comics collective, Samandal, which I briefly mentioned already. Samandal and their network have been working with all different kinds of comics, including nonfiction, since their first issue in 2007. In 2017, in fact, five cartoonists from France, Syria, and Lebanon, including Samandal co-founder Lena Merej, created a project called Meantime, which used comics to document Syrian refugee camps in Lebanon. It was published in English, French, and Arabic. I brought a copy of that as well. I was able to break Samandal's network from individual contributors to members of their editorial collective over to create and publish paid work for the NIB. This provided a pipeline for comics that would have otherwise only appeared in Europe or the Arab world to be published for the NIB's primarily American audience. We do have a global audience, it's a website after all, but we read the metrics and our audience was mostly American, North American, there's Canadian. So I want to give you an example of the stuff that we're putting out at this point. So Hussein Adil is a cartoonist who lives and works in Baghdad. I met him on Facebook through mutual connections that I'd gotten from Cairo Comics. I saw that he was producing nonfiction comics that looked amazing, and I reached out to see if he wanted to make them for the NIB. I'm going to actually read two stories of his that we commissioned for him that I got to edit. Because he's Iraqi and this is around the anniversary of the war, I feel like it's important. This is the first one is actually about the first Gulf War, and the second one is about the second Gulf War. So this is Black Rain on the Highway of Death by Hussein Adil, which I edited for the Empire issue. February 26, 1991, 2 days before the end of the first Gulf War. After a series of defeats at the hands of the American-led coalition, the Iraqi army was hastily withdrawn from Kuwait. Adil Darwood, an Iraqi private from Nasiriyah, was amongst the lines of retreating tanks, armored vehicles, buses, and civilian cars. Oops, that's hard to read. I wonder if I can hide that. Can you hide it? Yeah. Okay. My name is Adil. I was 25 years old when the war broke out. I planned to enroll as a student in the Fine Arts Institute, but instead I was drafted into the army. War stole half my life. War dreams still play in my head. I had to abandon my painting supplies at the camp when we left. Those drawings exist now only in my memory. A battalion officer was hysterically jumping, screaming, and searching for shelter. You're all crazy. I won't go with you. I'll stay here. You're all going to die if we leave the camp. We carried the officer out and pushed him into the front seat of the car. Leave me here. It was one in the morning when we left the camp. I sat in the bed of the truck to protect myself as we turned over. I pushed my body into the bags of stuff that we brought. After an hour and a half, we reached Highway 80. It was terrible. A line of military vehicles heading to the Iraqi border. I felt sad and broken. But not because we were losing the war. It was because I'd fought in the war and I'd been forced to do so. Anyone who refused to be drafted would be subjected to the most severe penalty. All the soldiers of the world are victims of the whims of their superiors and their leaders. At 3 a.m., the bombing began. There were 7 air raids by the American planes bombing the Iraqi vehicles that fled. On the 8th raid, a missile hit the vehicle in front of us. The bags of stuff that I pushed my body into saved me from the impact. All survivors fled into the desert. It was a horrible scene, corpses and burnt vehicles littered the road. We had to walk beside the highway. The border was about 4 days by foot. Only one other soldier from my battalion survived. His name was Aben. He was 52 years old and wounded. I had to hold him. After 2 days of walking, it rained. I remember that day clearly because I'd never seen rain like that before. It was black rain. Black rain covered my face and the faces of the other soldiers. It had mixed with the smoke from the Kuwaiti oil fields that Saddam had lit on fire. We were more than 1 million soldiers. At one point, we paused for rest, only one day from the Iraqi border. I felt peace in that moment. It was like we were in another world filled with endless soldiers. As we all started to get up and to finish our journey, I begged refused to walk. I dare, I can't move. You finish walking, leave me here. It's only one day. Just imagine your children and wife waiting for you. He decided to walk. I begged, don't surrender now. Soon, black clouds covered us. There was a black smoke coming from the burning oil field. The black smoke was everywhere. Ava, where are you? We were all ghosts walking on the road back to our home. So that was Black Rain on the Highway of Death, which is from the perspective of the Iraqi army being bombed by American planes, which is honestly not a perspective that you often experience as an American reader. Hussein, he sources all of this stuff from interviews and then creates these narratives based on them. So I'm going to read one more about the Second Iraq War that I also got to edit. Here's another story. This one ran in the city's issue of the Naked magazine. It's called It's Not a Game. I am Haider. It happened in Baghdad in 2004 when I was 11 years old. I went with my family to attend a relative's wedding. I wasn't interested in the party. My goal was to play with their PlayStation, and I was obsessed with a GTA game. When I was playing, I heard a noise. Go away, don't do this here. A group of mafia army militia members were trying to fire a missile near the door of the house. Then I heard loud explosions and nonstop gunfire. Everyone in the party ran away or tried to hide. I looked out of one of the holes. I saw many militia members filling the street. There's an armored car on the other side of the street. After the end of the US-Iraq war in 2003, many militias appeared, including the Mahdi Army militia, whose goal was to fight the American army. They controlled the city and imposed their religious system on society. They tried to ban songs and only allowed their war songs to be heard. They hurt everyone with long hair. Hours later, the bombing intensified. On that day, a militiaman shot down the American helicopter. The pilot escaped and hid in a mosque. Militia members surrounded the pilot in the mosque until the American military convoy came to his rescue. My brother went out to find a car to take us home. Night came and he didn't come back. I was taking cover with my family under the stairs of the house to protect us in case a missile fell on the house. We worried about him so much that I knocked on the door. We thought it was my brother. Who is there? It was a group of Iraqi and American soldiers. We're looking for someone who fired a missile near him. We asked if they had seen my brother. He's hiding in a house a few streets away from me. After midnight, I left my family and went to play GTA until morning. The next day, my brother came back at 6 a.m. to the car. All to the car! The city was full of corpses and American army battalions. Wow, mama, look. On the way, I saw a scene I'd never forgotten. An old woman selling cheese near an American tank. As we approached the house, we had to stop because of the intensifying shelling and shooting. Run, run! We left the car and went out on foot. We arrived at a street with a sniper. We did not know which side we belonged to. We crossed the street one by one to avoid the sniper. Finally, we got home. The next day, my brother went to get the car and we left. We found that a missile hit the car, but it did not explode. All I wanted to do was play my game. And that is the end of that one. You comic, I have seen with you. Oh, another NIB contributor I've edited a lot is Yazan Afsadi, Syrian Canadian who grew up many places, especially Kuwait. He lives and works in Beirut. I actually edited Yazan's first public comic and he pitched it directly to me. That's because I met him in 2017 in Beirut. while I was there for the Cahill Awards, a comic award at the American University of Beirut, funded by Salaf and organized by Lina Haibe. I first met Lina in 2011 through her twin sisters' association with Samando, and then we saw each other again at Cairo Comics in 2016, where she invited me to participate in the judging in Beirut that year. Yazan Al-Sadi is a journalist, former MSF worker, an amazing comics writer who gets other cartoonists from the region to draw his work, which I edit for them. So he's created comics about Sudan, about Egypt, about Palestine, about Yemen, about Bahrain, which I'll read one of those in a minute. But the great thing about Yazan is that he worked as a journalist prior to being a comics writer. So he really approaches it from that perspective. And I'm going to read one of his comics that I edited, which is about Bahrain. It was drawn by Hadi Hosn, a Lebanese cartoonist and former Simondal editor who now lives in France. Bahrain is Arabic for two seas, a fitting name. The body of water it sits in is subject to dispute. Whether it's in the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf depends on who you ask. Two names for one sea. Names are one thing, history is another. And in Bahrain, looking too far back in time can get you in trouble. From far away, Bahrain seems minuscule, quirky, harmless, rich. Cluster of islands in the Gulf, Qatar to its east, Saudi Arabia to its west, Iran's shoreline far across the water. 295.5 square miles in size, population 1.5 million, 800,000 international. Ruled by the Al Khalifa family since 1783. Home to the naval base of the US 5th Fleet, linchpin of the US wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Since 2011, it has been rocked by revolution and crushed by counter-revolution. So when I use the I here, I'm reading Yazan's narration. I worked as a journalist during the 2011 uprising. While having a drink in Beirut, Lebanon, a friend told me a story that took place in Bahrain, where she worked. She was teaching history in Manama, the capital. After Bahrain's ruling Al Khalifa family came from Zubarah, Qatar, and conquered Bahrain in the early 1780s, that's the factual scene. The next day, a student from a powerful family complained, "If you ever mention the Al Khalifa family being from Qatar again, you're out." The ruling Al Khalifa family is adamant that they are eternal. They are Bahrain. Bahrain is them. You understand? But Bahrain's story has more depth. The country's strategic location along the shores of the Arabian Peninsula has long been precarious for its people. The island saw domination after domination. Babylon, Persia, Alexander the Great, Islam, the Portuguese, the Safavids, and finally in 1783, Ahmed the Conqueror. Backed by a fleet from Kuwait, an army of several clans and tribes, Ahmed bin Muhammad bin Khalifa seized Bahrain and established a dynasty that has ruled ever since. In the early 1800s, the Al-Khalifa turned to the British to shore up their rule against regional rivals. The British recognized the dominance of Al-Khalifa and handled their security. When petroleum was later discovered, the British stopped it. The baton of empire was passed to the US during World War II. Although the British officially left in 1971, the Americans maintained Al-Khalifa's control and faced their largest national presence in the Middle East and Bahrain's waters. Bahrain's people never remained silent about Al-Khalifa's absolute autocratic rule. Far back as the 1920s, Bahrainis launched one of the oldest civil rights movements and the first leftist political party in the Gulf region. Almost like clockwork, uprisings flared up every few decades. Representation is at the heart of the struggle. Al-Khalifa is Sunni, while the majority of Bahrainians are Shia. It is not just about respect, which Al-Khalifa did exploit to divide and rule. There's also monopolization of resources and the land rights of the ruling family, on top of Bahraini society's marginalization on political, economic, and social level. Abuses like collective punishment, murder, exile, large-scale incarcerations, and torture fuel dissent. Inspired by uprisings in the region, the Bahrainis mobilized once again on February 2011. At one point, more than 300,000 Bahrainis from different sects and backgrounds flooded the streets, roughly 43% of the national population. akin to 140 million American citizens protesting simultaneously. Luckily, the security forces clamped down swiftly, backed by the Peninsula Shield, the regional army of the Saudi-dominated Gulf Coordination Council, the GCC. Protest spaces were bulldozed, emergency care for protesters was criminalized, and NGOs like Doctors Without Borders were ousted from the country. Thousands were incarcerated. Thus, Bahrain has one of, if not the highest prison population rate. The uprising was tarred as an Iranian and Qatari conspiracy and ignored. In 2014, which is when I was there, from Beirut, I spoke over the phone with Nabil Rajab, a prominent opposition leader and human rights activist, about these challenges. Even the Syrian regime supported the Peninsula Shield's invasion of Bahrain. Repressive regimes work together, but we are still finding it difficult being allies. Solidarity, it is our only hope. Not long after, Rajab was arrested on October 2014. He was released on July 2015, arrested once more on June 2016, and earlier in 2018, sentenced for criticizing the Saudi war in Yemen and disseminating false news statements and rumors about the internal situation of the kingdom that would undermine its prestige and status. Mariam Hawaja, Bahraini Danish human rights activist. She has been jailed, lives in exile, and faces an arrest warrant and a handful of pending cases. Her father, a human rights activist leader, is currently in prison for life and has been tortured. She perhaps articulates it best. When I'm asked to describe the revolution to audiences, especially Western audiences, I resort to calling Bahrain an inconvenient revolution. It's inconvenient to the West, the US, and Europe. It's inconvenient to the GCC and other Arab regimes, while Iran uses Bahrain as a bargaining chip. There are reasons why coverage of Bahrain is limited. And Al-Khalifa manipulates discourse and mechanisms of international human rights accountability to buy more time. The West simply says, oh, the Bahraini government has promised to reform, promised to stop abuses, promised accountability, give them time. But things are getting worse. Trump's meeting the Bahraini king on May 2017 gave the green light for more repression. 2 days later, Bahraini security forces attacked a peaceful sit-in, killing 5 people, injuring more than 100, and arresting almost 300 people. This is the deadliest attack. But what they don't realize is Bahrainis will continue to protest. It's not going to stop, not at all, not until they get their rights. This was a comic by Razan. Well, I was also in Beirut for the Kahil Awards. I gave a talk on nonfiction comic, not unlike how I'm doing now, and put out a call for Lebanese cartoonist Hitch the Nib. I convinced the person who brought me there, Lena Haibe, to do a comic for us, which I got to edit. Lena is Syrian Danish and grew up in Yemen, Syria, Denmark, and Lebanon. Her comic was about the Syrian school system under Assad the Father's regime. It was a really good comic. Lena also runs the comic program at AUB, organizes the Kahil Award, and is generally amazing. Wataz Sawaf funds the Kahil Award in her department at AUB. Sawaf is a Lebanese construction magnate who got rich in Saudi and poured money into the Arab comic scene. He actually is sort of like he'd wanted to be a cartoonist when he was younger and then became an architect instead for the Bin Laden group. He built parts of Mecca. He's like wildly wealthy. I've only seen him as a giant floating head on a screen. He also funded early issues of Simondal before the collective got into a fight with him over rights ownership, because if you might recall, Simondal is all about copyleft, dissemination, and he wanted to own all of the things they produced that were not okay with that. Cartoonists working for the NIB are not only writing about their own countries for American audiences, but also writing about the American experience as well. This is an example of a comic I edited by Virginie Le Bon, the French journalist who lives and works in Beirut and Khalil, comparing abortion law in the US and Lebanon and framing a transnational struggle for bodily autonomy against theocratic law. At the same time, all of these amazing comics are being published. First Look Media decides the NIB should function as a profit-making enterprise in the media company umbrella, unlike our FLM sister company, The Intercept, which is allowed to function as a nonprofit. This means that there is a lot of merchandising. It doesn't stop with merchandising. First Look Media commissioned the NIB animated series, which lasts for 2 seasons on the internet, lets us pitch the round. Netflix passes. We even make NIB emoji during a brief weird period when it's popular to replace your emoji set with a personal one. I don't even know what was going on at this point. Marketing departments for startups are unreal. As all this monetization is being attempted, what is really happening is that the NIB is paying a ton of cartoonists a lot of money to make nonfiction comics. The creators own the rights to on a regular basis. It is also paying them in US dollars at the same rate as any American cartoonist, no matter where they live, because though they are blocked by a border, these cartoonists are part of a transnational information and art delivery network. So what is going on here? First Look Media is trying to build itself up as a publisher of political material. It wants to bring the NIB's existing audience, which is active and consumes that content, to their platform and find a way to monetize it. Monetize what the NIB brings to their brand, and if successful, use that to fund its nonprofit project. So basically, we were supposed to fund Glenn Greenwald's salary, which is big money. We got in very public with Glenn Greenwald. He ran The Intercept at the time. As part of the deal to acquire the NIB, First Look buys the NIB name, unlike the agreement with Medium. Again, Boris negotiated creator contracts with First Look, in which creators own the intellectual property they generate for the site, and First Look licenses the comics that Boris and a staff commission for a short period of exclusivity. This brings me back to where that work is being published, which is the platform. If you're in control of the platform, you should be mindful and intentional of who your readership is and who you bring to them. Bringing voices to that platform that would not have been there otherwise makes you useful to those voices and also makes the platform a more interesting place. Out of all the ways that marketing tried to monetize it, the only one that we ever really cared about was the pipeline of a website and establishing a print quarterly magazine, which would give us an independent subscriber base that would make our bottom line not depend on First Look's funding. The magazine could be used as a physical object to periodically remind subscribers why they like the NIB and give them early access to comics in a physical form that we wouldn't have to pay while online. If we want to, in the spirit of Simondal and all these other guys, get our comics out there as much as possible. Putting comics behind a paywall on the internet sucks. People like to read free comics. So if you give them those comics as a prestigious object that comes out, and then like nobody else sees those comics for a month and then they start publishing online, there's a reason to subscribe. Gradually over 3 years, a thriving ecosystem built up around nonfiction and comics journalism. There are conferences, other media publications have their own competing comics journalism publications. Everyone is getting paid. It's like an amazing golden era. Then Nephilim fired all of us and a bunch of other people in the video. And Karen Media are lighting it all on fire. So to retain the rights of the NIB name, get exit packages for employees and secure the IP, Boris, Larry, Shay, and Maddie had personally generated for the NIB. All direct employees signed a non-disparagement clause. This means you can't actually say what happened. But since I was a contractor, because I was always part-time working on books, I didn't have to sign an NDC, which is why I'm the only editor that can talk to you about this stuff. And I'm going to tell you the real story of what happened. What happened, this is a real story, is that Elon Musk's sister, Tuska Musk, convinced somebody at First Look Media to buy her project Passionflix, which was described as Netflix for romance novel adaptation. The budget for the buying of Passionflix was roughly the NIB's yearly operating budget, which was slashed accordingly, which is like amazing. We're using this money to like pay people all over the place. So it's like, thunk. Anyway. I'm sure Tosca did great things with that. Agreeing to the NDC also gave Boris access to the Inkwell membership program, which became the only operating revenue source for the NIB because they basically slashed all other funding. We got a listserv and people's recurring credit card payments that got them their books. It's way less money, which means that we can commission way less stuff, about a third of what we were doing when we were funded by Pyramid Yar, but it's stable, and now we don't serve at the whim of morally questionable oligarchs anymore. The main perk of the membership program is the print quarterly, which is where most of my NIB work is these days. The NIB's platform has withstood its loss of funding and seen created and resilient. The State Department and tech oligarchs that fund the blooming of an art community rarely align with what's best for that community. I think it's important if you ever encounter something like this in your life, to figure out what you can get out of the relationship and then bite the hand that feeds you. Basically use their money to build something that outlasts their interests. Trump will get elected, the people you know at state will get fired, the tech oligarchs will decide that they're not interested in politics anymore. And you wanna have something that outlasts when the Eye of Sauron moves away. So I've been talking about editing other people for a while now, and I really love working as an editor. But I actually spend almost all of my time set up in my attic room drawing my own comics. So now I'm going to talk about Spring Rain, which is the memoir that I wrote about the political violence and uprising in Lebanon between 2005 and 2011. Spring Rain began life as that mini comic that I made at CCS for a class assignment while pursuing my MFA. I self-published it and sold it at conventions for small press distribution. I was also developing the material that would become the book in an indie comics anthology I was co-editing called Irene. Irene was founded by DW, Dakota McFadden, and I while we were all in our last year at the Center for Cartoon Studies, based on my experience with Simondal working under Omar Khoury and learning how to basically run a comics collective. The first issue was us and our CCS classmates, but by the second issue, we were trying to publish cartoonists from as many places as possible, again, in the spirit of Simondal. Irene was also an opportunity for me prior to the NIB to publish Lebanese cartoonists I was friends with, like Omar Khoury and Barat Rima. They have some early Irene issues over there, where you can see some of the early times when people from Simondal were getting published in the American media market. Irene also gave me a personal space where I could experiment with work not tied to my freelance career as a comics journalist and create fiction and memoir. So I started writing pieces that were more personal. I put together the pitch for the book. So I was finishing up Brief Histories of Everyday Objects in 2016, and then I pitched the book in 2017. With the material that I developed in Irene and The Man Who Built Beirut, I had already made visuals and blocks of my story to work into a pitch. So if you want to pitch a book, you need an introduction, story outline, sound format, marketing promotion, and author bio. My process was I had a lot of materials. I had two diaries, I had a ton of reference pictures. I had interviewed a friend whose name I changed, who I was there at the time in 2005. To make sure that my memories were aligning with hers. Then I'd interviewed another friend during the 2011 time. I then moved into scripting, thumbnailing, and editing. I really had a lot of personal material, including letters, two journals, a public-facing blog, as well as a bunch of weird narrative for no reason. The book tracks a mental breakdown, which becomes very apparent in my journey, in my journals when I stopped writing down dates and my handwriting changed, which is a problem when you're trying to write a narrative. So to actually figure out what things happened when and how I would translate them into memoir, I had to create a spreadsheet cross-referencing my blog posts and diaries and then planning out the sort of narrative work, transforming them to nonfiction and the editing. To give you a little insight to my process, I always print copies of my thing, things, and then go through with basically highlighters. And often I have one highlighter color that says write better and one highlighter color that says draw better. And that's how I edit my thing. I also sometimes make 3D models of places if I'm going to draw them a lot, or this is a 3D model of the apartment that I lived in Hamra that I made. I'll use other people's 3D models as well. I work entirely digitally and have since 2007. So it's very easy to integrate this sort of stuff into my workflow. And this is what it looks like as finished pieces. I worked with two gray tones and a heavy spot black that wouldn't necessarily correspond to where shadows were really falling, that was more being used as sort of a design element that I was using to whip the reader's eye around. And I had to draw a lot of crowd scenes for this book, which I then, the next book was about animals. I didn't have to draw a crowd scene for that. And then the following book was about plants. And I realized that drawing like enormous fields of wheat is almost as bad as the uncuts. But I do like the drawn buildings, so that was really nice, especially Beirut is a very, very pretty city in this kind of strange way that there's interesting graffiti everywhere and different pockmarks from different conflicts and gorgeous architecture. And it's just a lovely place to kind of stroll around in. And so I got to draw it a lot for the book, which was nice. I did, however, learn that if you make a book about having it really hard for like 2 years, comics take a really long time to make. This book took me 2 years to make, and it definitely made me depressed again. So that was part of why I then veered into YA after that, instead of making books about animal domestication, just to make myself happy. And it worked. What you work on affects your mood. So the world of nonfiction comics isn't a wash and set up cast anymore, but there's still a lot that's been going on lately. Since the 80s and 90s, nonfiction has been a mainstay of comics publishing. Think of the success of Mouse and Fun Home. It's not only grown, it's only grown, and new publishers are beginning to appear that are choosing to specialize in nonfiction. One example is a publisher called Graphic Mundi, which is an imprint of Penn State University, which is soliciting and publishing nonfiction comics, some of which began life on the Nib. Again, that goes back to the fact that creators and the stuff that they produce for the Nib does not seek rent. So we're always really psyched when people take their books to other places. Another is the imprint, YA imprint of Little Brown. I actually am putting out books for them right now. I've put out one, I'm putting out another next year, and I'm contracted to put another out in 2 years, all nonfiction, and they have a real nonfiction focus. I'm also still working with everyone that I've mentioned so far. But especially Azana Saadi, because he's amazing. On new comics. This is one I did with Omar Khoury, my old friend, the Samando co-founder. I'm not going to read this one because I've already read a few comics, but about the Beirut Blast. This comic about the horrors of the Beirut Blast in 2020, one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. Editing and working with material like this allows me to maintain a connection to the city, even as I haven't lived there in years, because I'm in sort of a dialogue with journalists and artists and writers that are producing work that is coming out of Beirut. And in this sense, I was able to go back. Yazan Asadi also worked with Lena Munzer, Bernadette Daou, and five really cool Lebanese women cartoonists to produce Where to Marie, which I've brought. Which is an anthology of women's stories telling the history of Lebanon from its founding through the 2019 Beirut uprising and the You Stink protest. I mean, Beirut has lost a lot of them. One of the artists featured in Where to Marie is Tracy Chahan, whom I haven't mentioned yet, but is also key to the scene. Tracy is from Beirut, now lives in Pittsburgh. She's been part of Samando's editorial collective, and I first met her in Beirut in 2017 when she was still an art student in college. She's considerably younger than Omar, Lena, Bids, and Hatem, who are older than me, and was part of a generational handoff that includes other cartoonists like Joseph Kai and Bharat Rima and many, many others. Tracy has collaborated extensively with Yazan, as well as me and Shay Merck, one of the other editors of the Nib. This comic of hers, written by Yazan, was featured in a symposium and exhibition put on by the University of Oregon in 2021 called Art of the News. Art of the News also featured Yazan Asadi, Omar Khoury, Shay Merck, Joe Sacco, and many other amazing nonfiction / journalist cartoons, and me. It was organized by Catherine Kelp Stebbins, who's associate director and assistant professor of comic studies at the University of Oregon. It's interesting because it's sort of watching this scene that I've basically always been a part of my entire professional life begin to be looked at by academia and exhibited, which is always strange. We had grad students present papers on our own comics in front of us, which is not an experience I care to repeat. In 2020, Guantanamo Voices was published by Abrams Books. It's an anthology, again, of comics written by Shay Merck, my longtime Nib co-editor and friend, who reported in person on Guantanamo. Still open, by the way. Drawn by a crew of artists, including Tracy Chahuan and Omar Khoury. And I actually now assign this book in the nonfiction comics classes that I teach at Stanford and CCA to bring the circle of influences around full circle. I'm also editing comics right now by Yazan Asadi, Andy Holston, and Omar Khoury, amongst others. This one is about MBS and Neom, and creating comics about MBS makes everyone very nervous. Forward. as a way to begin to close this out. That is, by the way, a real thing. So people that I work with in Egypt often work under pseudonyms, and we're very careful to protect them. The same thing goes with people creating work about Saudi. We have so far been unable to get a Saudi cartoonist to create work about Saudi for obvious reasons. And the cartoonists that create that work for know what they're doing. As a way to begin to close this out, I want to begin to point out that I'm really only tangentially related to the scene of comics produced in the Arab world. From my early connections with Simandal and my role getting them published in the US media markets related to nonfiction. I also only really deal with work in English, sorry, or that I can help translate into English, mostly in French. That's a narrow lens. The amazing art that this thriving community is creating has found its way through many separate channels into the US and also into European, especially French markets. The scene is way bigger and more interesting than who just got published on the NIB. This is an example from Angoulême, highlighting the scene that grew up around Simandal and then Tok Tok and then sort of went supernova across the region. There's a through line here that I'd like to point out, which is the role of the comics medium as a way to work with a transnational identity. Nerd culture and fan culture blossomed in online spaces like social media, forums, and public portfolio sites like Tumblr, Behance, and DeviantArt. The internet allowed kids to connect no matter where they were and develop a common language and set of interests and cultural references like Dungeons and Dragons or giant robot anime. Comics brushing up against these very passionate and often very young communities creates a space that not only transcends borders, but resents borders, sometimes creating art intended to push against or destroy them. Comics are also really easy to make by yourself, which makes them very difficult to sell. Cartoonists often say that they're mascots of comics. So now, after talking about what I do for a long time, I'll explain how I do it and why. A lot of my career is based on being fascinated by things and finding a way to communicate that fascination about it. This is the introduction to my first book, Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, in which I muse about where shower heads come from. They're actually, it's a boring origin story, but it got me started on a whole other thing about toothbrushes, but then became my first book, and then people bought that book and then made more books. Everyday objects is a constraint that I placed on myself to generate stories for a project. It's funny because it's making boring things interesting. Stories are everywhere around us. They are the air that we breathe, and the key to nonfiction is to catch them. A simple way to generate stories is to place a constraint on yourself that narrows the kind of stories that you are looking for. As you keep lists of ideas, look for ways that they're connected. Are they pieces of a bigger story that you're putting together? What are their narratives? Sometimes amazingly weird stuff. It's just falling through now. Flat. This story is, I got to do this one. This is very funny. So there's actually a real guy that dressed up in a bunny suit and threatened teenagers with an axe in Virginia in the 1970s. It sounds like an urban myth because it then became an urban myth, but it's really a thing that happened. And this librarian like found the story because he was obsessed as a child. And I did a whole comic about him. My process is all digital. I write the script in Google Docs or slides. I thumbnail while editing text down and then get reference imagery. I digitally ink a layer and edit text further and color the final. And I draw with usually a computer right here and an iPad right here with reference and images showing windowed web browsing and 3D modeling. And then I'm drawing directly onto the iPad screen using Photoshop, but also to Procreate and working with keyboard shortcuts to manipulate the programs. If you're curious, my most viral comic ever was about the caretaker of a local mortuary's columbarium in San Francisco. I don't know why. It's just the internet. Happened on Tumblr. People still see it. And lastly, I think it's good to consider what comics are a good medium for telling nonfiction stories, particularly. One is accessibility. So if you kind of split these two things, the block of text becomes a big blur and you can still sort of see the action of the comic. There's this idea of the immediate experience. Comics are this grabby, hot media. And a lot of that has to do with the visuals and the fact that even if the text were to become incomprehensible, there's a way for the reader to find their way through the forest of the story. I'm myself a demand gravity. So if you have basically more than half of a dialogue of a panel filled with words, the reader turns off. It's this weird form of magic where you can have a book of prose, you can have a picture, you can even have a book of prose with like a spot illustration. But once you reach like the halfway point, the brain starts hating it. And so readers like a good balance of words and pictures. This makes cartoonists become good at summarizing information. Brevity forces you to focus on what is important and how to communicate it. Comics also break up ideas into panels, which are units of narrative storytelling. This forces you to think about your information in digestible chunks. There's also the aspect of visual learning. This is pretty important. Information in a comic will stick with the reader in a different and often stronger way than if they read it in prose, because it becomes associated with pictures in the reader's mind. It's why science textbooks have diagrams. People come to me and they tell me that they remember stuff from my comics in a way that they don't remember stuff from other histories. That's the visual learning aspect. It's not because I'm a more talented storyteller, it's because I draw cartoons. There's also the visual explanation aspect, which is basically the toolkit of a graphic designer. Cartoonists have access to things like timelines and inset panels where you can have narratives run concurrently. They can use maps, they can use charts and data visualization. They can use infographics, they can use schematics and cutaways and have all these things coexist in a narrative space that's also kind of moving the reader carefully through a story. You can give them a spot like this that, unlike in say a documentary, if you show this time is ever moving forward, there's only so much time that the viewer can pause and look at that schematic. With a comic, they can actually sit with that page, and you can encourage them to do that as a creator. Finally, and this is the last thing I'm saying, a word of advice if you want to make a career in the arts too. You should, it's really fun, I love it. The most important thing is to finish things and then get them out into the world. Everything that I've done has come back to me because of something that I've gotten out into the world. Often, several years later, my first book was a mini comic that editor picked up at a store 2 years after it had ended up at the store's shelf on consignment. And that became my first book. So you never know what will come back to you. The spirit with Samandal and getting works out, copy left, distribution is more important than gatekeeping. That spirit has gotten me a long way in my career. And I encourage you, if this is something that interests you, to be similarly inspired. Thank you.
No, better. Okay, I don't want to yell into it. Hi, everyone. I'm Danielle. I'm just going to start off with a question or two, and then if anybody has questions in the audience or on Zoom, feel free to ask away, and I'll bring the microphone. So you started to get into it with your last few slides, but I was curious. In your memoir, Spring Rain, you imply that your nonfiction comics allowed you to kind of sort through both the psychological and the political events that you're living through in the early 2000s in Lebanon. So I guess more of a general question that I was hoping you could elaborate on is, how do you think our society could further utilize artistic tools as a means of understanding current events?
Sure. I mean, a lot of my career is sort of based on that kind of interpretive work. When I function as a journalist, even when I function as an advocate, I've done work for UN agencies and the Center for Constitutional Rights and NGOs like that. It's using comics to basically do interpretive work to, it's why they work so well for science as well. And politics are sort of a similarly thorny thing to explain that benefits from visual diagrams often. You know, it's that like graphic designer's toolkit where you can draw out political parties, you can draw out maps of influence, you can draw out timelines to process the information. I myself kind of process information in a I will hear something and then sort of add it to the file cabinet, like memory palace it. And I'm always looking for connections to other aspects of things that I have previously digested. A nice aspect of my career is that as I draw, I can actually listen to media. I can listen to podcasts or news or things like that. And so I take in nonfiction that way and sort of have a constant oral input that I'm like categorizing in different places, which is soothing. It's nice.
I'm also a bit curious about your personal art practice. Do you have a personal art practice? And if so, like, what ways is it different from, and which ways does it intersect with your professional work?
It's kind of the same. I mean, I don't, I have full control over my books that I publish, and I also have control over my pitching process. What I pitch pretty much gets picked up because of my relationships with the publications that I work with. So I work on what I am interested in, and what I really love is nonfiction. I mean, I think about it all the time anyway, about different ways of thinking about the world and fitting the world together and explaining parts of the world. And so it comes very naturally to me. So it is, it's work, it's my career, but it started off as a hobby, and I was making zines and things, and it's sort of become a career. So it is my practice. And then when my partner, Kathy, has always had a 9-to-5 job since we both graduated. Ever since I've been a cartoonist, you can have like vampire hours for that, or work on weekends or whatever, but it was always important to maintain personal relationships as well. And so I've structured my life of having a kind of 9-to-5 job. I start working on comics at 8 or 9 when I drop my kids off, and then pick them up and I'm done. And there's no urge to then retreat to a studio and like paint something. But I do have too many projects. I'm contracted to do 3 books and like have several personal projects at work. So I'm always ping-ponging between stuff based on interest.
Gotcha. Awesome. All right. Does anybody in the audience have any questions? Bring you the microphone for the sake of the people on Zoom.
Really great to see you again, Andy, but I'm going to try to ask you 2 real questions. So one of them is more, I guess, an academic question, because I was thinking about, you know, other traditions of comics, like the French one, which you know well, or even manga, and wondering, you know, what your sense of how sort of historically the American tradition is. I just don't really have a good sense of it. It's kind of Marvel, or I mean, I just wonder how this kind of work emerges from the tradition. So that's the kind of academic question. But then I'm also curious about things that you have, you know, projects that are in front of you or in process. Maybe you don't want to talk about them, but I'm sort of curious, partly because you mentioned, you know, which was actually rather moving, and you know, the difficulty also of doing this really courageous work and delving into very painful, unjust situations, you know. So I just wondered how you balance, you know, what, having done things that don't demand that from you, do you have other kind of works of that sort that you're planning for the future, or how do you think about that? And then third is just a comment, which is this is so interesting and so incredibly informative and just really, you know, very stimulating. But it also makes me think how important this medium is in the midst of the kind of saturation of images because they're digested.
Well, it also creates fetish objects.
Yeah, but I mean, the one that you rock was incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that, of course, we've all seen, and the pictures are, you know, recycled through a million different formats and all that. So it reminds me how really powerful this is. So that's it.
Absolutely. Thank you. So the first part was the other influences. So American comics, just a quick, like a 90-second survey of the way that American comics differs from the other. There are three main comics traditions in the world. There's Japanese manga, Franco-Belgian, Beide, and North American comics. North American comics come out of newspaper comics and then become big serialized. All three of those big markets are sort of independently, they come into their own independently, they influence each other, but they all have both a kid's focus and an adult focus. And in only in North America, there's a moral panic in the 50s. We're great at both. It's called the 10-cent plague. There was actually a congressional hearing where they dragged the publisher of EC Comics, who were the people that put out Mad Magazine and like the Tomb of Horror and all the like horror comics. They dragged him in front of Congress and made him like admit to corrupting the youth. And the industry, out of fear that it would be essentially like blackballed, self-censored, like the film industry did as well, and neutered. That's actually the reason why American comics are known for superheroes, is because the only genre that survived that really was in a viable form of superheroes. And Archie Comics was the other one. Archie Comics is the only one of the romance comics. In the 1950s, the biggest buyer, consumer of comics were actually like teenage and preteen girls, because the romance comic market was enormous. And then the 10-cent plague killed all of that because they were considered like moral turpitude. In a place like Lebanon, you wouldn't have many serious American comics. You'd have a lot of superhero influence coming in. You'd have very serious comics though being produced and coming in from the Franco-Belgian tradition. And those actually make their way in a serious way to Lebanon for obvious reasons. I mean, former French colony, et cetera. Tradition is very present in Lebanon and very influential on Lebanese comics. And then one of the other big, the way that the Japanese tradition affects it is actually through public television licensing. So kids in the 80s and 90s grew up watching stuff that was like licensed, on TV. And a lot of it would be these big robot, like mech anime. Grandizer is one that I remember specifically. You would see name checked a lot, and people would do like big murals in Beirut about it. And like, it would pop up in comics and stuff like that. And so people would be, they weren't necessarily reading manga, like the actual physical form wouldn't make itself to like a Beirut bookshop, but they would be absorbing the aesthetic through like the TV presentation. What am I working on now? I'm contracted to do three books. And I have another book that I finished that's coming out next year called People and Plants, that after all my work being happy about making a book about animals, this one was about plant domestication and how plants are commodities. And then it became about how people treat each other like commodities. And then it became about imperialism and potatoes. And I don't know, like somehow I made it like depressing. But it's YA, so it can only be so depressing. There's a lot of dumb jokes in it. And the book after that, that I'm just starting to write, is about materials. It's the third in a trilogy. The first one would be animals, the second one, vegetables, and the third one, minerals. So it's like steel and gold and things like that. And they're three different history books for kids, trying to get them to rethink the way they're taught and consume history by doing object histories. I'm also working on a book about the southern coast of Hawaii called Volcano Coast, that's been partially grant funded by the National Park Arts Foundation. It'll probably come out next year or the year after. The southern coast of the Big Island is a really interesting place. It's the most volcanically active part. And you can buy land there for $5,000, set up a water catchment system, set up a solar panels, and like live. And so there are very rare people there. And it's also a landscape that has been sort of generationally marked by a cataclysm because of the volcanoes, but also tsunamis, earthquakes, like periodically the water will just suddenly get poisoned because like it comes through lava tubes and it becomes seawater instead of fresh water. And so it's like this place where for about, you know, 300 years of recorded history, they've been dealing with periodic cataclysm in a way that like we're starting to. So it's a study of that. And then the last thing I'm working on is a book with a physicist from UC Irvine about whether or not we can do Carl Sagan's idea of using physics to talk to aliens. I'm not writing it. That's an example of a book that I'm illustrating. I'm kind of editing it to make it funny, but he's writing it. He's done three other books before. He's a very good writer, including his work with Kirkman. So he's quite fun to work with, but I have, he could be making up everything and I wouldn't be able to. The hazards of working outside of your editing expertise. Yeah, that's that. And then it is always coming out with new issues. The next one is the Colors issue just came out and the Futures issue is the one that I'm editing a piece about MBS and NEOM.
And back to the Zoom question. Right, I have, I have two different questions on Zoom. So if there's somebody else, we can kind of interleave with someone live and in person. So on Zoom, Lisa Stratford has asked, do you receive pressure from people with political agendas? And if so, what does this consist of? And perhaps I would say to extend it to, you were talking a little bit about the, you know, the pressure that some, that some folks feel coming, you know,
yeah,
about self-censorship.
I think there's a broad way to look at this. One is that comics exist in, like, people don't care about them enough, which they are sort of allowed to fly under the radar in a certain way until suddenly they aren't. Like, there's been a Syrian cartoonist famously had his hands broken at the outset of the civil war there. And cartoonists were, had their doors kicked in and were shot in, that was an awful episode. Anyway, that was in 2011, but the, it happens periodically. With this sort of stuff, there's sort of two angles of pressure, right? Because there's an international thing to consider and there's also sort of the domestic landscape. The NIB was very active in 2016 during the presidential campaign in what sort of has been called in retrospect kind of waggishly the meme wars, which are when basically like people were fighting each other on social media with comics and memes, which are often repurposed comics. Pepe the Frog is actually drawn by a cartoonist that I kind of know. I know his brother and my boss knows him. And so during the height of that, we commissioned him to draw like a response to the way that Pepe had been like taken by Nazis, American Nazis in that campaign. And with that comes a like public facing pressure. Like I was front paged by Breitbart personally in 2016 and that sucked. But I'm also like a, you know, straight presenting white guy, so I can like take it in a way. Like the blowback from that is a lot less than it would have been for some of my other editors had it happen to them. So yeah, it happens and it sucks when it happens. And that made me like retreat from social media a little bit because that's less of a battleground there. The international thing is a whole different kettle of fish. That is where you're working with people who, you know, are sort of setting the limits of their own personal safety in a way that I don't yet deal with here in this media market, emphasis on the yet. But there are best practices and you adhere to them, and also people really self-police, like working on the piece about MBS, like the cartoonist is careful what he draws and the writer is careful what he writes. And that's a fact of life. And if you're publishing anything about Egypt, you're doing it under a pseudonym. I don't know. It's worth it to provide a sort of a space that isn't beholden to an out. Like, I know who funds the NIB very directly. Like, it's literally funded by our mayors. We used to be funded by an oligarch that I hated. And it's worthwhile for me to take the heat to provide a potential outlet that otherwise wouldn't. I wouldn't know. I know that I can trust this organization that I work with, and I feel good about platforming the people there, basically. I don't know, it's a long roundabout way, but yeah, I mean, pressure happens. It's not great, but it happens less to me than others because of what I look like and what my name is. So that's my privilege.
Any other questions from anyone here? I know there's a question. All right,
okay. Maybe now. Oh, jeepers. I have a sort of a long intro here to a question from Swathi Suvarna about climate change, cartooning and climate change. They write, "Hi, Andy, thank you for your inspiring talk." Swathi is a city planning grad student and whose exit project is research titled Cartooning for Climate Change, based on a workshop series. I'll just read in Swathi's voice. I've been conducting over the past year. I first conducted it in collaboration with the Karam Foundation for Syrian refugee students to talk about climate justice issues. I'm exploring cartooning as an alternative medium for engaging in participatory planning processes and to talk about pressing issues such as the climate. And here comes the question. I'm curious to know about the reactions or critiques you've received for your comics on climate change and how receptive or not people are when it comes to engaging with those issues through a cartoon medium.
Great question. You were talking about pressure. Actually, the biggest blowback I've ever received was about doing pieces about controlled burns in California. It's wildly controversial and people like will yell at you about it on the internet. If you platform the scientists who think that it should happen. But outside of that one very specific example, it's a great medium for it. Again, because of the heavy lifting that comics can do for scientific interpretation. And it has been used that way a lot. And I would totally encourage you to explore that. There's great examples out there, including probably by big NGOs. I mean, I personally worked on a guidebook for the UN to talk about marine protected areas. And it was sort of focused. It was an interesting project because it was an advocacy project, but it wasn't focused at people outside of the organization. It was like to teach government technocrats about marine protected areas in a little booklet info comic. So it's really a fantastic way of delivering information. And the classic example of this is the airport exit card in the front of here. That's a comic, and everybody sees one every time you take an airplane and you know how to get off the plane. So comics are a very easy way of explaining things, and climate change is one of the big doom pressing things. So a lot of people have already used the medium to that end, myself included. Pushback, the wildfires, the actual people seeing it, love it. I've worked multiple times with the UN because they recommend, to another branch of that enormous agency. I've worked multiple times with science with labs at universities doing sort of interpretive work with their scientific papers, because again, it's a really good medium for that. And people, the scientists or the policymakers that are creating the material that I'm basically interpreting, love it. I mean, like, it's fun to see yourself in a comic. Like, even if it's about the world burning, I don't know. It's just like comics are fun, even when they're sort of soul crushing.
Yes, that's it. We'll conclude.
Thank you. Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much.